The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we've come to the last talk of this six-week series on the Satipatthana Sutta, loosely on the Satipatthana Sutta. So I'd like to say a few words this morning about the fourth foundation of mindfulness. But in a bigger sense, it really is looking at the question of what does it mean to live with wisdom? You know, what does it mean to live a wise life? And in a way, all of these practices are not that meaningful if they don't inform, affect, shape our whole lives. You know, we're not, the purpose is not as kind of a spiritual tourism, you know, having different, seeing different sites and going. It's really, you know, developing our minds and developing our wisdom and letting that, be our gift to ourselves and to others. So, that's one thing to say. And then another thing is that it's often been said before that meditation practice or Dharma practice is not so much about gaining something, but it's very much more so about subtraction. You know, we're subtracting, we're continually letting go or freeing ourselves from whatever is extra. And so the idea is that everything we need, we already have, but it's been covered over through our habits, our conditioning, our craving, our clinging, all the different ways that we struggle with how things are. Somehow in that struggle, something gets covered over. So this process of subtraction, this process of continually letting go. One famous Zen teacher asked the question, what dies in meditation? What dies in meditation? And he answered, whatever is not true is what dies. So this continual process of freeing ourselves from what's not true. And in the process, what is true begins to stand out. Our light begins to shine. Nothing we need to do or create, but just this continual process of simplifying, of letting go. So in a way, you can see this arc through the meditation instructions. You know, we're simplifying our experience. We're connecting to the body, becoming alive to just the simple sensations of body. Then as we move to the mind, that it's possible to trace back all of our preoccupations with greed, with wanting to hate, aversion, ill will, not wanting, to this very simple experience in the moment of pleasant and unpleasant. So we start to become more sensitive to this flow of pleasant and unpleasant, constantly changing. And then we begin to notice the mind itself, the mind state, how the mood in the mind, the quality of the mind, the way the mind is relating to experience actually builds that experience. It colors it, it shapes it, it creates the experience. When the mind is one way, the exact same circumstance or condition will be experienced one way. And then when the mind is a different way, it could be this, you know, the same circumstance is experienced totally differently. You know, there's nothing inherent in a traffic jam on 280, you know, that should create stress and suffering, yet it always does. You know, it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. And so this way of relating to experience is what we call in Dharma practice mind. And you could say the whole arc of practice, the whole direction of practice, the whole point of practice is to bring that relating mind, that relational mind, bring that relationship with experience to peace. You know, what is it? What would it mean to be at peace with the sounds on the street, to be at peace with the traffic, to be at peace with the difficult thoughts or emotions or memories or difficult people in our life? You know, it. So peace may look different, differently depending on the circumstance, but it's that quality. It's that quality of letting go of all the extra. And so in a way, what this points to is all of this mindfulness, or the purpose of this mindfulness training, is to bring us to a place where we have a choice. You know, where we have a choice. Maybe you've heard this distinction between reacting and responding. You know, often we're in reactive mode. Something happens, we react. Another thing happens, we react. I opened a bill last night, which is always a, you know, for me anyway, not a easeful, relaxing way to, right before I go to bed, but I opened this insurance bill. And then the amount seemed a little strange to me. And I say, oh, this is lower than the amount that I just paid. That's strange. And then, I could immediately feel this reaction. You know, it's like, something happened, something's wrong, something, you know, it was just the mind, just... when there's mindfulness, we can see that something is challenging, is difficult, but it creates a space for us to choose how we respond. So that difference between reacting and responding. So, you know, I could have continued the reaction and, you know, sending an angry email to the insurance company or to the insurance agent or something. But luckily, there was a tiny bit of mindfulness enough to say, well, there should probably be a, you know, maybe there should be a refund here. Let me check my credit card thing. And then, oh, yeah, sure enough. Yeah, they put a refund in the next day. It's like, oh, you know. Oh, and then I thought, wow, I would have really embarrassed myself if I sent a, you know, left an angry voice message at 10 p.m. This weekend, I was going furniture shopping with my family, and it was probably not a good idea to bring my two toddlers. You know, this big, beautiful, modern, cavernous space with people who are dressed very nicely, talking quietly, and important things are happening, and everything was good for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and then it just slipped into just this screaming. Or, you know, both of my daughters wanted to climb on the same chair, the same stool, and it was screaming, and this just echoed through the whole big space, and I'm kind of looking at the person who's helping me, and she's trying to keep talking to me, and it's like, well, hang on a second, you know, and then I try to pick one of them up, and then they both want mama, they don't want me, and they're screaming that they only want mama. And then it's okay, we have to go, and we just take them and bundle up everything and just walk out. And I could feel the, you know, just the frustration and just the, you know, in me wanting to get something finished, and then it's happening. And then I looked at my daughter, and there was part of me that just wanted to, I'm not a believer in spanking or whatever that is, but every parent probably has the spanking impulse. Just wanna, but then some moment of grace or some moment of mindfulness, and I asked my 3-year-old, I said, would you like a hug? And then she went from being really angry and really just, yeah, you know, and just that shift, that the shift that's possible when there's space, when there's a moment to just pause and let something else influence us, let some little bit of wisdom or some little bit of patience or something return. So mindfulness is the practice that can create these spaces, bring us to the moment where we see we have choice, where we have intention. Just like we were sitting and we could bring intention and bring, you know, make conscious choice of how we sit. Usually we just sit, you know, we just lay down, we just flop down. But in a way, every moment is like that. Every moment is shaped by and can be shaped by our intention. And so we're always making choices, but often we're not aware of them. And when we're not aware, well, first of all, when we're not aware that we have a choice, we really don't have a choice. We're stuck in reacting. We're stuck in reactive mode. And then the choices or how we react is informed maybe by the less helpful mind states, by the hindrances, by the, you know, by our habits and conditioning. So in a way, mindfulness practice is this kind of deconditioning. Moment by moment, we start to see we have a choice, and we can make different choices. So this fourth foundation of mindfulness, which the word that's used is mindfulness of dhammas. It could have that word, that Pali word could have a lot of meanings. It's usually translated as phenomena, so just whatever the mind notices. Gill sometimes talks about this as mindfulness of truths with an S. This is the place in the instructions where the teachings of the Buddha start to become our actual experience. So it's like learning how to notice these ways of experiencing, and in some ways learning how to consciously work with them, one of the commentators talks about this as seeing the world through Buddhist or Dharma-tinted glasses. So that sense of ways of seeing dharmically, you could say. And the section starts off with the hindrances. This is what we talked about last week. These forces in the mind that keep us distracted, keep us preoccupied. Greed and aversion, you know, wanting and resisting. And then restlessness and worry on one side, and sloth and torpor, dullness, laziness on the other side. And then the fifth one is doubt. So I saw one way of talking about these hindrances that was using the example of the energy that we experience. So the first one of a sensual desire, greed, sensual desire, is the energy is going out. We're sending the energy out. You know, it's, you kind of know what that feels like to be leaning forward into something, to wanting the next thing or the next cookie. I had a cookie last night, where there were a few cookies left in this container on the counter. And I noticed that, I took a bite of the cookie, and then before it was even really chewed, there was like this movement for another bite. that's this sensual desire. That's this, the energy's going out. You know, before I've even really chewed and experienced and enjoyed what I had, I was ready for the next thing. You know, this is how desire works. It's looking for more, wanting more, wanting that experience to continue in time. An aversion is, or ill will, aversion is just the other side of the same coin, is wanting to get away from something, wanting it to stop, resisting it. In this analogy, let's see. Desire is the energy is sent out. And then, in a way, aversion is the energy is stopped, is locked up, is, you know, is kind of frozen. It's like, it locks us in. If you notice working with physical pain, it's like in meditation, the more we resist it, somehow that locks it in, that solidifies it. It's in that process of resisting. And then, let's see, sloth and torpor, this kind of dullness, the energy is just sinking, you know, it's just that sinking feeling. It's, there may be energy in the system, but we don't have access to it. It's not necessarily really a physical energy drain, but it comes from the mind. You know, when we don't want to do something, we don't want to hear something, you know, then it's like, oh, the sinking. Then the other side of that, too little energy is too much energy. The energy is frenetic. It's wound up when there's restlessness and worry and anxiety. I think the example that they say is that the energy is quivering. And then with doubt, this is one I really like, I really can relate to. The energy is circulating. It's like it's spinning. It's spinning in itself. It's not going anywhere, but it's moving. You know, and the quality of doubt can sometimes be like this. Doubt is said to be the most difficult hindrance to work with in the sense that it's the most difficult to see. You know, usually or often we can be so submerged in doubt that we don't notice that there's doubt present. It's just like, I can't do this, or this is not, you know, even in times of meditation, when meditation can be going very well, there can be this little voice that's like, you can't do this, or this is not real, or something. You know, this is doubt. This is doubt. You know, if we ever second guess ourselves or undermine ourselves, or, it's so helpful to turn and just notice, this is doubt. So these hindrances are talked about at the beginning of this fourth foundation of mindfulness. Why? Because they are what get in the way of the mind settling, of stability, of stillness, of concentration, of depth. It's not a big mystery. It's not like, well, why can some people become very still and very concentrated and other people don't, or other people can't? The only reason is because these hindrances are operating and they're not being seen. So it becomes very, very important to become familiar with the hindrances, to work with them, to meet them with compassion. Oh, this is desire. Oh, this is restlessness. Oh, this is... You know, so we start to... one teacher I know talks about the hindrances as being like extended family. You know, we just get to know all these different characters, what they're like, how they move, how they speak. And the idea is that it is possible. It is very, very possible to come to a place in the mind or through meditation, through our practice, where these hindrances are completely at bay. They're completely, they may not have been totally eradicated, uprooted, but they've quieted down. You know, the noise has quieted down. I think we all have moments like this, but we tend to overlook it. We tend not to notice it. It's like, you know, we're not desiring every single second of every single minute of every single hour of the day. There are moments when there's contentment. There's moments when we're not resisting anything, not rejecting anything. There's moments when the mind, when the energy is just balanced, is just present. So working with the hindrances is very, very essential. And so as we practice as a mindfulness, and the basic way of working with them is meeting them with mindfulness, noticing them. So they're not, when we don't notice them, they control us. And when we start to notice them, they're just another thing. It's, oh, that's just, you know, that's doubt. That's just, you know, the inner critic. That's just some old familiar voice that starts to lose its power. And so as the hindrances, as we stop feeding them and we learn how they work and we stop indulging them, they really do start to fade. And as they fade, other qualities begin to arise. We start to feed through our mindfulness. Just this simple practice of mindfulness becomes the foundation and becomes the cause and condition for other factors of mind to arise. And these are the seven factors that I mentioned during the guided meditation. They're called bojanga in Pali. Usually they're translated as the factors of awakening, or the awakening factors. So in a way, these are the counterpoints to the hindrances. Actually, in the text, they're called, they're literally referred to as the anti-hindrances, or the unhindrances. Hindrances, the word in Pali is nivarana, which literally means the coverings. So these are kind of, they're called referred to in places as the anivarana. So maybe that's the uncovering. These are the factors of mind that begin to uncover something. So the first one is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the one is kind of the key that turns the ignition, that gets the whole car moving. And then the easy way of thinking about these or remembering them is that there are three energizing factors and then three calming factors. And you could almost see mindfulness is in the middle of the, you know, there's a seesaw. Mindfulness is in the middle. Mindfulness is balancing these factors. And so mindfulness in the middle, and then so on one side, there is investigation, energy. Sometimes energy is translated as effort. It kind of includes effort. And joy. And then on the other side, so investigation, energy, and joy. And the other side is tranquility, sometimes translated as calmness, calm mind, tranquility, concentration, samadhi, and equanimity. This balance of mind or equipoise, this detached mind, balanced, or So these are the seven factors of awakening. And in a way, it's like this is what the Satipatthana practice is leading towards. We're learning how to stop feeding the hindrances and begin feeding these awakening factors. One way they're understood is that there's a kind of causal link between them. When mindfulness is present, when we've learned how to recognize this capacity of mind, this simple capacity to know our experience, to understand our experience, we begin to get more interested in experience. You know, if you've had this the experience of working with the breath, it helps a lot to become interested in the breath, to investigate it and to become interested, to become engaged with the breath. It's like it opens up other worlds. We begin to see more details. Through that investigation and interest and energy, in effort, that brings energy, that gives energy, that energizes the meditation. So, through energy, through the effort that it takes and that engagement, what arises is joy. It's like, you know, so in a way, these factors of awakening aren't something that we need to practice, or even almost in a way that we can practice individually. They simply arise out of consistent and steady mindfulness practice. So as the hindrances start to fade, these factors start to arise: investigation, interest, curiosity, engagement, which unfolds a kind of energy and joy. You know, that we get a joy out of, you know, just as we know, just in other activities, when we're really engaged, when we're really, you know, I see my daughters doing their artwork and my mom does a lot of painting with them and other things, and they're so into it, they're so engaged, they're just having this joy of putting colors on the page, and in a way, they start to become calm and concentrated. It's like these factors are present, you know, in our everyday life when we're engaged in an activity and immersed in that activity. All the things that agitate us, you know, we stop thinking about them. We stop indulging them, and so a kind of a calmness and a concentration just arise. So this is very quickly just going through these seven, but it's just a way of seeing how they fit together and how each can condition the next one. So engagement, energy conditions this joy. And joy can be a cause and condition for calmness. You know, there's an ease that can happen, a tranquility when we're not feeding all the things that agitate us. Calmness is the supportive condition for concentration. We often think of concentration, of samadhi, as something that we have to will into being and make a lot of effort and concentrate and focus. But the Buddhist sense of samadhi is much more of this very natural collectedness of mind, which is supported very much so by a sense of well-being, a sense of ease, a sense of joy. All these help us to collect the mind, concentrate the mind. And through concentration, through samadhi, through unifying the mind, we can come to a place of balance, of equipoise. And this equanimity, we could say, is what this whole Satipatthana practice is leading us towards. When we have this equanimity, there's a balanced ease with the conditions of our life, or the conditions of our mind. What would usually upset us doesn't upset us. What would usually excite us, arouse us, energize us, turn on the kind of wanting mind, it doesn't have that effect. The mind is so balanced, so at ease, that it's just there. It's just, it can see all these changing conditions, but they don't affect the mind. If you know, I mean, I think we've all have had a taste of that. In this deep equanimity, the texts talk about what pervades it is this sense of letting go. This sense of kind of relinquishment, or just letting everything be exactly as it is. And it said, this is the state, this very, very balanced state where all the factors of awakening are balanced, all the hindrances are stilled, that this is the state where it's possible to experience a kind of shift, kind of breakthrough to what the Buddha talked about as the unconditioned. So when we say mindfulness is the Satipatthana is the direct path to awakening, it's the direct path to this state of mind, this balanced state of mind, where it's almost like in a way of experiencing it meditatively, we're doing less and less and less and less and less. It's this radical simplicity of the mind just simply resting, balanced. So there's maybe, you know, usually we're connected to the world of impermanence through heavy cables and ropes, and through the practice of mindfulness, that connection starts to thin and starts to thin out. And that thread, those threads become thinner until in the state of equanimity, there's just one thread, or there's just one, you know, which It's not even that we snip that thread. Because if we snip it, there's still a me of snipping it. But it's almost like the thread that just, at a certain point of just being with it, and that thread just drops away. And so, in a way, this letting go is the focus of the very final exercise in this text, Satipatthana Sutta, which is becoming mindful of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, probably familiar with this teaching, which simply says that there is suffering. You know, suffering maybe is not the best translation of the word dukkha, but there's suffering. There's sometimes people translate it as stress or as friction, unease, disharmony. There's some sense of disharmony or unease, can be the sense in our life. And there is a cause of that. The cause is our clinging, our attachment. And there's also, so the first noble truth is there's suffering. There's a second is there's a cause of suffering. The third is that there is happiness. There is peace. There is the end of suffering, end of stress. And there's a cause for that too. And the cause for that is to let go. Let go of the attachment of the forces in the mind that keep us from letting go, that keep us from this, just this very uncomplicated, simple way of being. So in a way, the Satipatthana practice takes us to the point where in our own experience, in our own meditation, the Four Noble Truths become alive. And it starts to become so clear that there is a peace available that's right here, that's right now. And the only thing that's blocking it is us, is me, is the me that is wanting, or the me that is not wanting. And as that way of relating, that me quiets down and becomes still, that's when the mind can open to this peace that the Buddha talks about, this freedom. But in a sense, we're not freed, but we free everything else. You know, we stop locking it in, and in that letting go, something very deep can be released. And then one of the interesting things about this quality of peace or this quality of freedom that can come from this letting go is that almost always in the Buddha's teaching, it's not described as an experience. It's not described, it will be like this great bliss or this great light or this great, you know. It's described by what's absent. It's described by this. It's literally what is absent is greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, when those three are completely absent, this state of peace is there. You know, so in a way, it's called unconstructed, unfabricated, unbuilt, because it's not something we have to do. It's not, it really is who we are, in a way. But it gets covered over, or it gets forgotten, or it gets obscured by these forces in the mind. So that's why getting back to just this simple practice of something like the hindrances, noticing a hindrance, is such a profound practice, because that is literally what is, you know, that's the kind of frost on the windshield, so to speak, you know. So this state of mind that is without greed, without hatred, anger, without delusion, is the fruit of the mindfulness practice. This very simple practice, you know, in a very simple, almost, you know, one of my Zen teachers says, you have to be a little bit stupid to do this practice. Because there's so many reasons not to do it, and so many, you know, so many interesting things in the world. This is kind of this very simple, steady, you know, to let ourselves be stupid enough to keep doing it, to keep coming back, even when it's boring and difficult and frustrating. And it's just that persistence, that kind of steadiness, the continuity is what wears these hindrances away. And then these factors of awakening start to become noticeable. It's like, wow, there was like 5 minutes of calm. It was really calm. It was really, the mind was really balanced. Someone said something really irritating, but there was no irritation. There was just, just kind of washed through. You know, so in a way we become more transparent, and letting things just flow through is sort of this feeling of equanimity, of letting go, of and then our own freedom, learning how to free ourselves, becomes a wonderful gift, not just to ourselves but to other people. You know, we don't have to lock them up, you know, in the way that we've been locking ourselves up. So we give them the gift of freedom as well. You know, that gift of really being present with another person, really allowing another person to be who they are is a great gift. And so to live with wisdom, to live with freedom, with peace, maybe it means that we have a lot more choice than we ever imagined that we have, you know, and we can bring wisdom to bear on these choices and make wise choices, and those choices we make, that those intentions that we infuse of love, of loving kindness, of compassion, that shapes our life, and it shapes our experience of our life. I hope it's so for each of us, that we can continue to cultivate this practice and this this beautiful treasure that we all have in our hearts, and set our own hearts free, you know, and in doing so, bring bring some kind of peace or happiness or freedom for all beings. You know, freeing all beings maybe begins with this one. You know, and then we may discover that when this one has peace or has freedom, then in a way that also frees all beings, that also sets things free. So, thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. For hanging in there through this six talks. We have a few minutes. Does anyone have any question or comment or, you know? I think one of the things that can be helpful in that that didn't really register with me or dawn on me until a number of years into the practice is just this sense of that there is a direction to the practice. There is a direction towards less suffering, less stress, and more ease, more peace, more freedom. And so in a way, it's like just to have that as a kind of barometer, it does take time. And early in our practice, it can sometimes seem like there's more stress, more difficulty, more suffering. And often that's because there's not necessarily more, but we're noticing more. You know, we're starting to notice everything, all the ways that we've, the friction in our life or the friction in our mind that we were numb to. You know, so we're defrosting everything. And then it's like, oh wow, this is really tense, this is really tight, or the body's tight, and the mind, and all these things. But as we practice, you know, there should be this movement towards less suffering, more choice. You know, the amount of suffering in our life is directly in relation to the amount of choice that we feel we have. You know, so through the mindfulness practice, creating the space where we see we have choice, we can see choices that lead to suffering and choices that lead to less suffering. So having the sense of this direction of the practice can be very helpful. Thank you very much. I wish you just enough faith or trust or confidence in the practice and in yourselves to keep going, keep coming back, keep connecting. That's really, you know, really all it is this. Willingness to come back over and over again. We get lost, we come back. We get lost, we come back. And at some point, just the way a puppy becomes trained, it's like the puppy stays. The puppy, we don't have to constantly yank it. The puppy just stays, and then it's like, oh. That's interesting. But it's wonderful, wonderful practice, wonderful exploration. And what I just to conclude, there's a famous saying by Ajahn Chah. You might have heard this. If you let go a little bit, you have a little peace. If you let go medium amount, you know, you'll have medium level peace. If you let go a lot, if you let go fully, if you let go completely, you'll experience the complete peace that comes with that letting go. So this points to the relationship of letting go and peace, but also that any amount of letting go is good. Until we become a Buddha, a completely awakened person, and I don't know if I've ever seen or met any person who would claim that, there's still more letting go to do. There's still more, you know. So, but any amount of letting go is good. Any amount of letting go. And just to let the peace that comes from that, savor that, value it, let it register. You know, the peace that, like, that letting go when, you know, kind of with my kids and we kind of give up shopping for furniture, just like, ah, okay, just let it go. Just let it go. And then that the well-being that comes from that. So in any moment, we can experience that. So, yes?
I have one question about the practice, which is kind of, where do you direct your meditation? And what I mean by that, as time goes by, I find myself sometimes spending too much time in my head, so I tend to focus on body scan and try to spend time in my body instead of my head. And then at other times, I feel a loss of compassion or patience, and so I do metta practice. And at other times, I feel my practice is floundering, and I do jhana practice. So I guess my question is, how do you decide where to direct your practice to give you the best path?
Yeah, you know, great question. It's, I mean, just as you described it, I think of meditation really as an art, almost as, I would say, much more of an art than a science, in the sense of, you know, The phrase that comes to mind is this Zen teaching about an appropriate response. So the student asked the master, what is the highest teaching of all the Buddhas? Some question like that. He said, how would you sum up the highest teaching of all the Buddhas? And the teacher said, an appropriate response. So you were describing various appropriate responses when the mind is scattered, you know, doing some collecting practice, some concentrating practice, when there's, anger, doing some metta practice, when there's suffering, meeting it with compassion. So in a way, it's like finding what is appropriate given the condition of this mind and body in the moment. One of the practices that I really like, I mean, a way of just, you know, bringing it, you know, into the kind of nuts and bolts, is to just sit down and just, you know, conjure up some feeling of contentment, some feeling of, you know, okay, I'm just sitting, things are fine. And then notice whenever, you know, the moment when we lose that contentment. I forgot to buy the milk. Okay, you know, oh, okay. Or something in the body or something, you know. Invariably, something will come up that, you know, if we're fully sitting and we're fully empty and transparent and equanimous, that's beautiful, that's great, just rest in that. And if something comes up that gets blocked, or, you know, we start to cling, or we start to, that becomes our practice. That whatever difficulty it is, whatever whatever shakes our tree, as they say, that becomes our practice. And we just very gently, whether it's the thinking or emotions or a physical thing or something, we just gently turn the mind and practice mindfulness with that. And then when that changes, we just come back to being content and just sitting, and something else will. You know, so that's basically how I like to practice, and just, you know, and just notice what shakes our tree, what takes us away from that natural state of peace. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.